Okay, how's this? Should we just start? And we'll let stragglers come in if they come in. Anyway, thank you for coming this early on a Saturday morning. I know it's probably pretty tough for some of you. It was pretty tough for me, so thanks very much. If you've got any questions during all of this, please, you know, feel free to come up and ask questions. This is going to be kind of an informal talk. I'll sort of describe the work that I've been doing, I guess, for the last year and a half. And I will just go through all different kinds of the modules that make up my project, and we'll see where we go. Now, okay, I'll talk about CRC Canada, which is here in Ottawa. Some of you might know it. Some of you know it very well. We'll talk about FreeWhirl, which is a VRML browser that, for this project, I had to take over the maintenance of. And we've been having a lot of fun with that. I'll also describe multicasting. Do people know what multicasting is? Does anyone use multicasting? Anyone use it? No? Okay, that's good. It doesn't work very well half the time anyway, so it's good you don't use it. But we'll talk about multicasting a bit, and then we'll talk about this multicast VNet information protocol, which came from another project. We'll talk about audio proximities, which we also use in our shared virtual world. And then I'll give you some idea of what kind of stuff we've got set up in our labs out at CRC. Now, usually when I do a talk like this, I do a couple of these, and we have a lot of people through our lab, especially a lot of military types, I have to ask them these kind of questions. You know, first, how many have had telephone conference calls? And of course, most people raise up their hand. Hey, all right, okay. And how many have seen Toy Story? Okay, let's do it. Who's seen Toy Story? Okay, now I usually ask these two questions and people automatically assume that they're going to be like Woody diving in to save Buzz Lightyear from whatever. Well, our goals aren't quite that complex. We just want people really interacting in real time, sort of across Canada or over to Europe. I found this little user-friendly comic, which I think is great. My cursor there. You know, basically they're sort of saying, wow, real life sort of looks pretty good. Can you read that? It's, wow, it's better than 1600 by 1200 resolution at 32 bits out here. And the guy says, can you imagine how many polys this area must take to render? I'd like to get something that looks quite like this. Maybe Adam's project is pretty good, but we'll see what we get. Okay, CRC Canada, it's been around for about 50 years. We're a government site. We're now part of, I think it's called Industry Canada. I've been an employee there for about 2 years and a contractor there before then. It's been around for a long time. All these satellites that Canada launches, I mean, I guess they're designed there, or some of them are designed, but they all get tested there. Even I think they test, I believe like there's dynamic balancing of satellites that are done, and there's two dynamic balancing things. One's in NASA and the other one's here. So I think all the Russian satellites come through our site and stuff like this. People don't know a lot about it, but it's stuck way out in the west end of Ottawa. A lot of radar work's been done. I think CRC is like pioneers in some of the neat radar stuff that goes on. I know some of the military work I did under contract a while ago. They were like really neat stuff. Can't say much about it, but it was all kinds of fun. The ARPANET, which is a predecessor to the internet. We're the second non-US member. Someone says we're the first non-US member. But basically, we've been connected to networks for a long time. We've got a lot of network connections. The CNET3, which is the Canada-wide research network. VBNS is down in the States. The CANTAT3 is a neat one. That's a submarine cable, meaning an underwater cable, which goes into the east coast of Scotland or England and then over to Germany. For a while, I had a Sun workstation sitting on my desk, which, if you traced route to it, it was at the University of Berlin. I had a 2 megabit per second dedicated line to the University of Berlin, so I could do multicast testing from one computer in my desk to the other, and it was really quite neat. The bandwidth was reserved by, I guess, when the government helps fund these things, they say, well, you have to leave a certain amount of bandwidth for research purposes. So we just applied for this bandwidth, and they gave it to us. So I had a really neat network connection to Europe. I've worked on a couple of European projects. Now, this all sort of helps relate why we get into these virtual worlds at CRC. These are European-funded projects, which as Canadians we can participate in, but we don't get money for. The Americans can't participate in, but I don't know. Politicians do wonderful things and say, yes, Canadians can join. They just finished, just wrapping up the last one. They're projects that lasted about a year, 2 years, and they were to implement and further multicasting conferencing over the internet. Now, everyone's sort of seen video conferencing. What multicast conferencing is we'll get into multicasting later, but basically it allows people to interact, let's say 5, 10 people, 20 people to interact in real time with each other. And usually we use audio stuff, we use video, and we use a shared whiteboard. One of the interesting things that came out of this was that the video was useless. You know, these little pictures, a couple of frames a second of people sitting in front of their computer monitors is, and after you've seen them for like 2 minutes, the video is actually not of any use. And it's the thing that takes up the highest amount of bandwidth. The audio was also kind of neat, but because it was like telephone conferencing where really only one person can talk at a time, it was limiting because, you know, you couldn't sort of go off, like Charles and I couldn't like go off into the corner and discuss something and come back to the group. We all had to sort of do things sort of around this one table, so to speak. The most important tool in our multicast conferencing was this shared whiteboard that allowed people to type. You know, you could choose a color and your name, sort of like John Stewart would be green, for instance. And you choose a corner of the whiteboard and you start typing. And Charles would sort of say, oh, I got to talk to John. So he'd be there typing away. And then after a while, we noticed that the audio actually disappeared out of these multicast conferences because everyone was typing to each other because it was the only way to get into separate little groups, which when you think about the whole aspect of conferencing, that's kind of backwards. You sort of thought, well, conferencing was, you know, TV and microphones and all of this stuff. Well, the main tool actually ended up being this shared whiteboard. Anyway, we'll take these ideas further in a little bit. But basically, CRC is a network-oriented organization, which is, I guess, kind of why I'm doing this work. I got involved in a project that had started without me, and this project was managed from the University of Ottawa, funded by this Canary organization. I'm going to do this backwards. I'm going to start halfway down the slide. This DIVE, this European DIVE project, this is not it, but this DIVE stands for Distributed Interactive Virtual Environments. And it was a couple of universities. You can see University of Ottawa and Western Ontario. And what it was to distribute a shared 3D environment over IPv6 using quality of service measurements to, you know, reserve bandwidth and so on and so forth. It kind of worked, but each of us did our own separate little things. I decided to implement this in Linux because of the... I've been using Linux since... I won't want to say because it shows how old I am. I've been using Linux for a long time. I like it. The other two people implemented in NT, which I thought just was not the right thing to do. So Linux it was. We got the project sort of working, but near the end I sort of thought, well, we've got people moving around in the world. Why don't we put this thing called audio proximities, where if you walk up to someone, you can talk with them. So again, that's the beginnings of the whole real interactive shared virtual world as part of this DIVE project. To implement DIVE, we used a system which has been around for a while called VNet, which was written by these two guys, Jeff Sonstein and Steve White. Now, Steve did this when he was at University of Waterloo. I think he's now down in Montreal. Jeff Sonstein was way out in the West Coast. I think he's now at the Rochester Institute of Technology, so he's getting closer. I have to get him up sometime. But it was a client-server-based shared virtual world system, all written in Java, and it was very slow, and it had a lot of problems with, you know, someone's machine. There'd be a network dropped to someone's machine, and all of a sudden everyone else would hang up, and eventually things would catch up, but it worked. But it had the idea of the 3D movement in a virtual world, avatars, you put them in, you have gestures, and it also had a little chat tool on the bottom. So it works, and they're still actually pushing VNet forward. We've taken the protocol that goes across the wire and have multicasted it. Now, again, these are, you guys know all of this, but it's all part of the whole thing, in that in terms of network bandwidth and speed, you know, things sort of increase as time goes on. Everyone's got a cable modem now, rather than the old 300 baud acoustic couplers that Radio Shack used to sell way back when. So there's a lot of ability to push a lot of data through, and it goes through fairly quickly. The end-to-end latency has dropped considerably. One of the things the CNET3 is doing, for instance, is it's all going optical, and they are reducing the number of routers, because every time something goes through a router, especially a non-optical router, it takes time. It's got to be sort of buffered in and sent out again. So the more routers you go through, the more time it takes for things to get from one end to the other. There's also the speed of light factor. You know, you can read the paper, and yes, someone says they've got something going faster than the speed of light, but in essence, you can only get data from one end to the other at the speed of light, or, of course, a lot slower than that. But you know, you'll never get instantaneous packet throughput from one bit to the other. There's an interesting story. I was got two little kids, and we went to see Ricky Martin at the Corral Center a couple of months ago. And you know who Ricky Martin is, right? One of these young guys who dances and all the ladies swoon and faint and so on. Anyway, they had this this big screen behind Ricky Martin. You know, he's a little guy on this big stage, and, you know, normal-sized guy on this big stage, and this huge screen behind him. And we were sort of at one end of the Corral Center, and Ricky Martin was at the other. And they had a TV camera right down, sort of not very far from us, taking pictures of Ricky to put up on this big screen. And, of course, it was all digital, because sometimes they'd flip bits around or put two pictures together or something. But it was interesting. I was sitting there watching this because there was such time delay through all of this. Like when Ricky Martin raised his hand, for instance, if he did a movement like this, by the time his hand started to come down on the big screen, his hand would start coming up. So it was like the delays from this whole system inside the Corral Center were really very visible. And so I was sitting there through the whole concert thinking, now what causes all of this? And talk to people at work, and we think it's MPEG-3 encoding, but anyway, it's amazing what you find when you go to the Corral Center with kids. Okay, this FreeWheel browser was part of our Dive project. I needed a VRML browser, which is part of Dive. I needed a VRML browser that ran on Linux, because I'd chosen Linux as my base platform. So I looked around, and I found one that was written by a guy called Thomas Luca, who was doing his PhD at Harvard. And it had elements of this EAI interface, which we'll get to in a little bit, which allowed me to allow movement, avatar movement, in a virtual world. And I started asking questions and making suggestions and a couple of patch fixes, and he sort of said, well, I'm heading back to Finland. It's yours if you want it. So I took this browser, which worked, well, it needed a lot of work. I spent a lot of time learning the internals of it. Probably 6 to 8 months full-time work is what I've put into it so far, and it's okay. It needs a lot more work. Fortunately, a lot of people are now helping me with it. It's open source, which means, you know, of course, everything's available for it. People use it for interesting things, like, for instance, one guy in Brazil, for training people how to fly one of those blimps, you know, like a Goodyear blimp, used it. So, you know, like rather than taking a blimp out and flying it around, they had the control panel, and it sort of the view outside the window was the blimp and the terrain below it. It's actually kind of neat. We have other people doing all kinds of weird... It's the Europeans especially that do all kinds of neat stuff with 3D. Not too many North Americans are interested in this for some strange reason. Anyway, FreeWheel was written in Perl, which when I started, I was a TCL TK person, and I didn't know anything about Perl, so... That was quite the learning experience. I didn't know object-oriented Perl existed, neither did any of the textbooks, until I really started going through to discover what these funny Perl statements were. Anyway, so it's written in object-oriented Perl for like the parsing of VRML and for doing event loop stuff. It calls some C functions for speed and for interfacing to OpenGL. Yeah, just speed-ups. You know, C is a lot faster. The Perl actually is quite slow. We use OpenGL, it's a project called Mesa. It was started by a guy called Brian Paul, who I think is now funded by the Precision Insight Group. It doesn't matter. But basically, it's implemented a very good set of OpenGL. And We now use that with 3DFX accelerators. Another interesting story. When I started, I got 4 3DFX accelerators about almost 2 years ago now, thinking, that's it. In order to speed up FreeWhirl, I'll just put hardware acceleration and forget about doing any Perl changes. We'll call it finished. Just, you know, hardware acceleration, just speed it up incredibly. Well, I'll put 3D accelerators in, and it slowed my code down by about 10 times. Okay, so rather than like 30 frames a second for things, it was doing like 3 or 4 frames a second. So fortunately now things are the opposite. The 3DFX drivers, when I started this, it was all sort of a guy in Germany just started writing these things. Now it's all paid for by the 3DFX people. So things are improving. Okay, one of the things, one of the problems with FreeWhirl and the problems with any virtual world is that you need to have things happen in real time for people to think that it's correct. The Perl, this event loop's written in Perl, it's speed problems associated with it. But generally what happens with anything like this is you have something that draws the current scene. Then it goes and says, well, this is what's changed. It sort of sends things out, and it gets changes back in again, and it goes back and draws it again. And the more complex the scene graph is, the slower the scene update takes. So if you're running at 30 or 40 frames a second, it works okay. If you're running 5 frames a second, then it becomes pretty unusable. I was, a couple weeks ago, I was flying a helicopter simulator down in Toronto, landing a helicopter on board the back of a Navy ship. It was one of these Sea King helicopters. And he had this huge Onyx 2 driving it. And even with the greatest, fastest Onyx 2 they could get, they still had problems with, you know, trying to limit the number of triangles, because the triangle drawing, in essence, sort of slowed them down. And they needed this in real time because they had real helicopter pilots coming in from, you know, that flew Sea Kings and sort of flew this helicopter simulator around. And they needed things in real time. I don't know. It looks okay. It was really actually neat to fly the simulator and look around and see the ship below you and bounces around and stuff. Fortunately, they did it in autopilot because I've never flown a helicopter. Another thing is VRML browser. It works okay. There are a few things that just aren't implemented in it yet, mainly because I don't need them. One of the first things that I did was put textures in. Years ago in graphics land, people sort of thought that little triangles were the things to make up pictures. You know, the more triangles you get, like you can make up anything with triangles. And then a number of years later, people realized, well, why don't you sort of take pictures and put them on things? Like rather than making a brick wall up of little triangles, just make it up and throw a picture on top, which is what they call a texture. So FreeWhirl didn't have very good texture support. It works better now for simple shapes, and I'm working on it for, you know, fancy polygons where you put hills in the background, for instance, and stuff. It had problems with memory leaks, which was great when you're doing demonstrations. You know, the faster it ran, the more memory it chewed up, so you'd have to always sort of like, no one's using it, stop it and restart it again. So I have to work on that a bit. Documentation is, of course, number one problem. No one likes writing documentation. And you know, who knows what else we'll find in this VRML browser. Now, VRML is a way to view a 3D scene, which is okay, but to me that's actually very useless. Because, yeah, you have a 3D picture, and yes, you can fly around, you know, the CN Tower, for instance, but it's, you know, after you do that for 10 minutes, it really is kind of boring. This external authoring interface is something that was going through for standardization. What it allows is it allows people to control a 3D world from an external program. For instance, from a Java program, you can go and say, I want to move the avatar of Charles over to sit over there, and you know, you just sort of send the commands, and all of a sudden that part of the scene graph moves over, and wow, the scene's changed without you doing anything. Also, when you do stuff, like if you click on an object in a 3D world, those get sent out to the program that drives the AI. It gets sent out so that actions that you do within your virtual world get, in essence, how can I say this? We use it so that if you move in a world, the movement is sent out and other people see you moving in the world. It's a way of just basically getting the 3D world to actually act and do something in life. Basically, EAI is it's all client-server based. Now, if you use like some of the other browsers, the commercial ones like CosmoPlayer or you know the new Blaxen one, it's all local. What we've done is made it so that you can use like sockets. It's all socket interfaced, so you can actually split your browser and your client and server, in essence, yeah, client and server between a couple of different machines, which is kind of neat because you can have one computer program drive a couple of different scenes. For instance, if you want stereo view, what we can do is have the EAI drive two different scenes, different computers on two different scenes separated by a very small margin. And some of the goggles we'll show you pictures later, some of the goggles, you know, have two different little TV, LCD to TV monitors there. So in essence, you can have stereo view very, very simply without a lot of expense. Who here has used VRML? Has anyone used VRML? One, two. Wow. Incredible. You know, a lot of people say VRML, what's that? So, now, we talked about this in the previous slide. Basically, the movements that, or the events that the EAI gives to you. Has anyone used the EAI interface? One. Okay. Two? All right.
Is this similar to Active Worlds? Can you use this
one? I've looked at it. Yeah. No, there's quite a few systems out there. Now, you know, we took this approach of not sort of saying yes, we're the world's first in shared virtual worlds, because I mean that's ludicrous. I mean, it's been around for a long time. What we're doing is we're doing this open source, and we're interested in basically having people share stuff across the country. So we're looking at the communication side of it. That's sort of our take on it, which is why we took this VNet stuff and decided, well, we'll take parts of the VNet and see if we can make it faster, see if we can actually use some of the networks that are available to us. So we could use another system, but we need access to it in order to instrument it. Okay, so by sort of rolling our own, so to speak, we can do whatever we want with it. Which, of course, is right what the bosses want us to do. So it means they say, yes, go and do this. So it's there's a few neat systems out there. Maybe, you know, later on, yeah, if you want to say something, what yours at, I mean, no? Okay, that's fine. If anyone else has got any neat systems out there they want to talk about, please, you know, say something. Anyway, EAI, just the movements we use, you know, say if you move in a virtual world, that gets sent out and replicated to everyone else in your shared virtual world. Same, you know, if someone else moves, you get to see that as well. Of course, you know, anyone can put different avatars in. Some of the neatest things I've seen people do with a virtual world, for instance, someone is their avatar put in the sun circling up in the sky. And he said, you know, click on it. So someone clicked on it. And what happened is his avatar changed, took over the whole background, and the whole background became animated, and it was like the birth of a universe. So that's a very interesting avatar. That was, he decided he'd be the birth of the universe. So, you know, it's not just people wandering around. It can be literally anything. Now, nice thing about having full open source is we can do literally anything with it. And what I wanted to do is to be able to drive this for many different things. So you can, no, rather than just using a keyboard and mouse, you can drive it with, like I've got a headset, which I'll show you later. Maybe you're literally driving a car with a steering wheel. Any of these different types of navigating a 3D world, we can actually very simply move in to this free world. And I had to learn something about quaternions. Now, another question. Who's heard of quaternions? All right. Can anyone describe really what a quaternion is? Can you? Okay.
That's
good. I'm not a mathematician, okay? I'm a computer scientist, whatever the heck that means. But my boss has got a PhD in mathematics, and sort of looking at this, and this free will use quaternions, and I sort of asked him, what's a quaternion? And my boss is, you know, in his 50s, so he went up to his bookshelf and his old books and, you know, blew the dust off the top and We found a definition of quaternions in these old math books, and he read it and he couldn't understand it. So, but that's a very lucid explanation. It's I guess the reason for using quaternions is you have four numbers and like four floating point variables to describe, in essence, a rotation. And rather than using six numbers, which you'd use if you used angles and positions, it's a lot easier mathematically in terms of time to generate a movement from one quaternion to another. Would that be a fairly good explanation? Okay. Please tell me if I'm wrong, but I just use code. I got off the internet on a gaming site for quaternion stuff. So, great thing about open source. Joysticks. I did a demonstration at the opening of a new building for the National Capital Institute of Technology or Telecommunications, and used mice to do this. And the night before this, I sort of thought, oh, this isn't going to work very well because these guys who don't know anything about computers are going to have to use this mouse. And anyway, so I whizzed up a joystick interface in a couple of hours and let my 10-year-old daughter fly it for another couple of hours till bedtime. And she couldn't crash it, so I figured if she couldn't crash it, then cabinet ministers and stuff would be okay with it. So it literally, because it's all open source and because I've got the ability to shove stuff in easily, the joystick interface took a couple of hours, and wow, there we were. You know, it was joystick. I had a positioning where you move forward, backward, left, and right. Very simple that, you know, say these politicians could understand. No 3D movement, so it was actually really very simple, and it worked well. Okay, enough of free will. Multicasting. Now, some of you guys know all about this. Maybe you don't, so we'll just sort of go through it very quickly. It's forgetting information around. Now, there's broadcasting, which is like, you know, cable TV or what happens, you know, if you send stuff to everyone on a local Ethernet. Unicasting is like point-to-point. Multicasting is a way of having broadcast capability without flooding entire networks. Like, for instance, when we were doing our audio-visual stuff to Europe, if we broadcast everything, well, you know, we'd go all over the world, in essence, theoretically. Realistically, wouldn't get to the remote end. So by multicasting, only one packet went across the Atlantic, and then from there it got distributed around. It's pretty fast when it works. It's UDP, so it's unreliable. So you have no idea if a packet will get to the other end or not. Okay. Again, basically, you know, multicasting. If I'm transmitting, all the routers set up, in essence, a multicast tree. You know, A, for instance, is me. B is on the local network, so it gets a copy. A router will in essence, fork the packets to send it to C and D. So, for instance, I only send one packet out, which is great if you are sending to many people. Rather than a different stream to each recipient, you only send one packet out, and it gets replicated where it needs to get replicated. And again, the reverse of that, there's another tree set up for every multicast participant. It's a whole separate tree set up. Now, this is all theoretical. Multicasting works, but it doesn't work. There are a lot of problems with the CANET 3 and a lot of problems over to Europe getting multicasting working. Okay, multicasting programs generally use this RTP framework, which sits on top of the network, which basically gives the ability to look at packets and describe what's there and tell what kind of packet it is. So we've basically implemented RTP. We're using, again, open source stuff. We're starting to use a package from a guy called Martin Malve over at University of Mannheim, who has taken RTP and modified it a bit for interactive applications, all written in Java, and it should just plug right in. I've started work on it. It should take another couple of days, and then we'll have a full RTP stack available to us. Now, audio proximities are the neatest thing that all these politicians like. Basically, I started to describe it earlier, where if you get close to somebody, you know, the closer you are in real life, the louder they are, the louder you can hear someone. Because of this microphone, of course, everyone hears me, but if it was like for me and, again, Charles again, you know, if I'm back here talking, Charles can't hear me. As I get closer to him, the louder I become to him. And the same is vice versa. Just like being in a party, you know, you see a group of people, you're close to the group of people, you can talk with them. It's as simple as that. So in this diagram, if two people, A and B, are within range, they can communicate with each other. If you extend it, you have the ability of having, you know, stereo, for instance, where if I'm standing here, if Charles talks, I can hear him in this ear. If Adam talks, I can hear him in this ear. But those two guys might be too far apart to actually communicate with each other. So basically, this allows us to mimic real life, and it allows us to do our multicast conferencing, where, for instance, if I've got to talk with someone to discuss something, we can go off literally in a corner and do our discussion via audio and then come back to everyone else and describe what our results are. Which, if you remember back to the beginning of the talk, the idea of the telephone conference call where you couldn't split apart each other, this actually works really kind of neat. Okay, some of the assumptions we made is that it's a research tool, which means if it works, great. If it doesn't, that's fine. We made assumptions, again, because CRC is very well connected, that we made assumptions basically that we've got a lot of bandwidth, a lot of good networks available to us, that packet loss, well, if it's there, it's there. If it's not, it's not. But we don't have to do a lot of work to get over very lossy network connections. We wanted to model human movement. Now, there's a thing called, the HLA-RTI, or DIS is probably better known, where the military use DIS for, like, doing battlefield simulations or something. But basically it says, you know, I'm a warhead, and I'm going to go that way, and here's my algorithm to determine my actual position. And so there's not positioning movement sent around to everybody. The only movement sent is when the warhead, for instance, changes direction. It'll say, there's actually periodic updates once in a while. But it'll say, here I am, and then it'll go off, and every node in the network is supposed to calculate where in the world that warhead is, and if there's a collision, then they're supposed to calculate that. We decided that rather than do something complex like that, that we would just assume that we're actually modeling humans, again, taking the audio-video conferencing. So, like, I could be here, you have no idea where I'm going to be in the next second. You know I'm going to be in the room, but, basically people are very random in terms of their movement around the world. We also said we're going to do a small conference, again, mimicking our audio-video stuff, which gets rid of a lot of scalability problems. So being in the research side is great. You can sort of say, we're not going to worry about that or about this. Just to throw all the hard parts away and do all the fun stuff. So if you throw all of this together, the VNet stuff, which we talked about a little bit earlier, the multicast conferencing and our high-speed networking, you put it all together and you get, in essence, our shared virtual world. Okay. This is, again, it's free world. It's VRML. It's the way everything works on a network. I'll go through this slide and the next slide too, which will describe how we fit in all the audio spatialization stuff. At the very top, I don't know if you can read it very well, but there's our VRML viewer, and it sends and receives events to this EAI level. The EAI is controlled by our Java program right now. It's in Java, our NVIP program. And MVIP, of course, talks over RTP, which goes out onto the internet. So basically, if you move your position, a position update gets sent through EAI to MVIP. MVIP says, okay, it's a movement. We'll send it out to everyone else. And it's as simple as that. The reverse works. If MVIP, if a movement comes in through the internet, again, it gets put up the other way. It's very, very simple. The neat thing is that this audio tool, this multicast audio tool, which is publicly available, called RAT, which is, I think, robust audio tool, it's all multicast enabled. It usually comes with a UI. All I did was replace the UI, so I have the media engine, which is stuff that actually does the sound, and I drive the sound and all the gain and the positioning for each individual member via this MVIP layer. Because I've got positioning information for everybody in a shared virtual world, I can place them. I can say, okay, well, that guy's way over on the left, but he's out of audio range, so we'll shut him off. You know, as he comes closer, gain is increased until he's, like, literally in front of you. In that case, it's full gain, and it's centered, you know, azimuth centered, and then if he goes off to the right again, out of the right speaker, and it slowly disappears. It works kind of neat. For demonstrations, we put a CD in and have music playing, so you can go up and you can chase each other around, and the closer you get to the CD player avatar, the louder the CD music is. But again, cabinet ministers love that kind of stuff, but they can't comprehend my kind of music. So, does anyone know who the Orb is? Ever heard of a group called the Orb? All right, okay, a couple people. Is it okay music for a shared virtual world? Great. All right. Yeah, I once put for my boss, I put on one of these, like country music singers and stuff. He's a country music guy, and it didn't sound right. You know, this avatar is doing country music rather than this really weird stuff. The events that I'm worried about right now are, of course, your position, which is X, Y, Z. Orientation is in essence, angles. You know, there's angles sideways, if you're up or down, or, you know, left or right, if you turn, for instance, that's, of course, all angles. Clicking is if you go and I want to do something to an avatar or something in the virtual world, if I click on it, that's an event that's sent out from the virtual world. Depends what you want to do with it. I haven't done anything with it yet, but the events are there. Gestures, you know, for instance, if you want your avatar to throw your hands up, well, you know, throw your hands up, avatar, and everyone else sees you throwing your hands up. And in the future, we'll see. These are things that have to happen in real time, meaning that, you know, if you throw your hands up, everyone else is going to see your hands going up at the same time. Things that just can happen at any point in time are what avatar you actually are. I mean, there's, you know, the avatar is defined in VRML. It can be passed around at any point in time. It's better if it's passed around earlier, but if I see positioning movement for a new entity, well, I can create an avatar, which is just maybe a ball, for instance. And when more information comes to describe that avatar, you can replace the ball with whatever picture you wish it to be, which means that you can't sneak around a virtual world. You can't be, like, invisible. You know, we actually see you no matter which way you are. This world checksum I threw in there because it's nice when everyone plays in the same virtual world. Be really embarrassing if you had a different, like, virtual world you were playing in. Virtual world is loaded when you start things up. Be really bad if you were like, you know, George Jetson zipping around some planet and everyone else was playing with dinosaurs. Get very confused. Proximity criteria is a way of telling people what you consider your personal space to be. And it allows people, for instance, to determine if I set my proximity criteria to, let's say, 10 meters, people sort of say, well, that guy's 8 meters away, so he should be able to hear me. If I set my proximity criteria to 5 meters and I'm 8 meters away, again, then you can sort of say, well, no, I've got to get closer in order to really be within range to that person. The amalgamation of tools is a neat one where we sort of say, well, we have, with this avatar, we've got this audio serial number, in essence, audio serial number associated with it. Maybe streaming video, you know, that's my picture over there, so I can, in essence, map that picture on top of my avatar if I wish. And who knows what else? We'll see what happens in the future. Now the fun stuff. How in the world all of this works together? It took a lot longer than expected. Free World didn't work all that well. There's still problems with it. OpenGL, I have problems with some of the calls. It works well on software rendering, but you throw it on a video card and all of a sudden the colors are way off, for instance. We've got a thing called the Polyhemus sensor, which sits on top of a pair of goggles, which I'll show you in a sec. It is a magnetic-based 3D or 3D positioning sensor. It's great when you're in a quiet area, but if you're around all computers, the picture jerks around and it actually makes people seasick. So we've got to work ways of getting that, like the transmitter and receiver, closer to each other. I'll tell you another story. To do all this testing for the code, for writing the code for this Polyhemus sensor, I took it all home because I live in a wooden house, and I had like one computer off in a corner, and I was working on this to make this headset work, and I got my little kids to try this to sort of see what they thought. And, you know, they were like there with these goggles, you know, I had a little tin man sitting, you know, virtually in front of them. They're wandering around, you know, looking at it and stuff like this over top. And then my older daughter decided to try and kick this thing. So it was interesting watching, and all of a sudden going, and she was surprised that it didn't move. Anyway, it's kind of fun. Another neat thing that happens is that with these goggles, You can't move very far. You're tethered by a cable, and the further from the sensors you are, the more jitter you have. So in essence, you can be there with these goggles, standing around looking at this virtual world while everyone else sails past you, because you really can't move. So, well, that's easy. Then we throw a joystick interface in. So you get these goggles on, and you've got a joystick which makes you go forward or backwards. But the problem with that idea is you need a framework. Okay, back to this helicopter simulator. When I was sitting in this helicopter, I had, you know, in essence, a joystick in front of me. It's a real joystick from a real helicopter. But virtually around me, I had the control panel in front of me. You know, I had a container for me to move around in. I could move my head, for instance, and look around. I could stick my head out the window virtually and stuff like this. But I needed this container to actually move me physically from one point to the other. So I think what we're going to do is, I've got a younger guy working with me now, and he's making it so it's sort of like a submarine. You know, you remember those James Bond movies where they hop on this little thing and go zipping underwater to, you know, to do some deadly deeds with a little propeller behind it. I want to do something like that. So he's now got the joystick working where you push a button and it starts to accelerate you and you can go up and down and so on. So we're going to make a sort of framework with these goggles where you drive around in this thing, a very simple shape underneath you. So you have a frame of reference so you know where you are. So like if you look up, you know, to the right and you go forward, you know that forward is in reference to this thing that you're sitting on. The problem with not having any framework around you is if you look up to the right and you go forward, you really don't know where forward is. You get so confused as to what's forward in terms of container movement. So that's just something we're going to do. Let's think about locating speed traps. It's not like I'm going to be like the police. I'm just sort of saying, got to speed things up to make it more realistic. Right now we're doing 60 to 70 frames a second for simple worlds, which is great. But the more people come in, the more avatars are in, and of course speed drops. So speed's always a problem. Our simple world, which we call Linux land, basically there are five people in a conversation here. You can see two tin men. There's one way off here on the very left-hand side, and there's another one back here. There's an emu, which is one of my favorite avatars, and a coffee pot. Now, there's only four avatars there, of course, because the fifth avatar is me, but I don't see myself because I'm seeing the world through my eyes, right? Now, you know, the person at the left would see a different viewpoint of the world. The coffee pot, of course, wouldn't see me because I'm behind it. Anyway, it's a very simple world and it works. One of the neat things we've done is we've put up two rear-mounted projectors. And these are two big screens. There's actually two positions. There are two avatars there, one side by the other, one each side. And these screens are rear-projected. And when you stand, you know, about a meter or two away from them, and it sort of fills your field of vision, it actually, for a very, very cheap price, it gives you a really neat feeling of actually being there. You know, you can spend a couple of million bucks on a 3D cave, for instance. But for, you know, 10,000 bucks, we got a couple projectors and screens, and it works pretty well. I told you about the goggles we put on. These are those goggles. That's not me. It's a styrofoam head. It's neat. They've got microphones and headset built into them, two little LCD displays, and this positioning sensor on the top of your head, so it's every head movement, in essence, is recorded. It's actually really neat. I/O devices, well, let's just show you pictures of joysticks, you know. These are the ones that took me a couple hours to integrate. The mouse is part of a $90,000 Onyx workstation, which was bought for military use, which isn't used right now. But it's, why use that when I can use Linux? So the only reason I use the Onyx is it's got Cosmo Player on it, another VRML browser, so I can actually, when I do changes to FreeWorld, I can sort of say, oh, this is how it works in Cosmo Player. How does it work in mine? So it's the most expensive test bed, I think. What do we have here? You know, just some of the computers. You can see there's two projectors. These are the rear-mounted projectors. In the very bottom left-hand corner, right-hand corner, you can see the Onyx, this big purple dinosaur. And there's amplifiers and stuff, and all kinds of fun stuff. For the goggles, I've got them in my office. You can see in the left-hand side of this cable coming down, that's the back of the goggles. In terms of saving money and being a good government employee now, for the position sensor, you can see it in this wooden post. Well, the wooden post is like a 50-year-old telephone, a 50-year-old coat rack that I just took the coat hanger things off and screwed my position sensor on. So it actually looks pretty professional, you know. But it was mine. And one of the last pictures of me doing one of the demonstrations. You know, we've got a room in the background. You can sort of see one of the positioning, one of the avatars back there, and so on with the goggles. People think it's kind of neat. Basically, Free World, we're developing it. There's snapshots that go on the website pretty much every week now. It's neat. There's different applications that are using it. I'd like to speed it up, maybe do some more C coding, different I/O devices. I've got a thing called the Space Ball, which you sort of grab and it's all touch sensing. You pull on it and you go up, for instance, twist it. It's like a pool ball, nice and soft and squishy, but it's sitting on a neat little box. I've got all the information on how to program that from the company. So I'd like to throw that in because that would give us real neat 3D movement. Status, well, this dive project that I talked about earlier, the code's on my website, which I'll show you in a minute. This positioning works, the RTP framework started, Linux and Java, let's go quickly. The neat thing is audio spatialization. The neat thing about open source software, there's a lady across the hall from me who does a lot of neat military work where I think they put goggles or earphones on someone and they spin them on a chair, for instance, and they say, now where is that sound emitter? You know, it's great for people in military. Is that good? Do you know if that's okay as a description of this?
Well, it was built for they did was they were trying to do soldier system, where they were trying to give the soldiers where the other person was coming from.
Yeah.
So they created a soundscape so that you can you get where the other person is and where and so Fred's off here, you hear him coming from off here.
Yeah.
And it was all part of what they called the integrated clothing and equipment, which has been delayed a little bit.
Yeah.
But anyway, the actual thing, when you feed it, a signal and you feed it a direction that you want the sound to come from, and it makes it come from there.
Yeah, it works. This RAD audio tool has spatialization, which was thrown in, which if you're sitting there with headphones, you can sort of say, yeah, okay, that's off to the left. When I was given a demonstration of this, it was like incredible. This algorithm was like, it's off to the left, it's off to the left. You know it for sure. This has just been released under like the BSD open source license or something, GPL open source.
That's the problem we have this week.
Yeah, this RAD audio tool is BSD license. But basically, in essence, things will get resolved. This neat audio spatialization thing developed for military use will be put in this public domain audio tool, and it'll be just great. Anyway, we'll see what happens in the next little while. Basically, we've talked about all of this. I'm not going to go through the conclusions. Best thing is, there's my website address. Can you read that? I wrote a paper as well. I've got one paper for this conference. I haven't seen any conference proceedings. Has anyone seen them? No? Does anyone know about them? No one? Well, yeah, there's in that website in the link section, there's actually my paper which I wrote for this conference. Grab it, read it if you want. It describes our site, our project a little bit better. Anyway, that's that. Any questions? Any comments? All right, go ahead.
Avatar shout?
Can avatars shout? You could do that in a couple of ways. One is with a gesture. The other, of course, is because
it only works
everyone. The best thing, okay, you mean shouting like in terms of everyone hearing you?
Yeah. Or if I'm further away from you and I want to talk to you,
Okay, I understand that. What happens is that right now, no, but the reason for sending my proximity information around is that, you know, I can, for instance, say if my proximity is like 100 miles, then in essence, everyone should be able to be within proximity of me. So if I talk, people should be able to hear. So if you want to be really obnoxious, you can set your proximity to be quite big for things like that. Did that answer it? Yeah. Okay. It's not there yet. I mean, I'm spending so much time in free world right now. So a lot of these things are just delayed. So, any other questions? Okay. Well, you and the brown first. Okay. Yeah, and that's the whole aspect behind the, if you click on an object in the world, we've got a researcher working with us who is into sharing objects big time. He's got avatars programmed up which actually walk to each other and throw a ball, for instance, and the ownership passes from one to the other. The idea of clicking on an object, we were hoping very simply to implement it, like if you see something you want, you click on it. If it's free, or if you're given permissions to get it, then it's yours, then it follows you. Again, the whole focus of this is not really to be the world's best shared virtual world, but to allow multicast conferencing across, let's say, Canada, and to have the spatialization work. The whole idea of getting objects is there.
But I'm thinking more to a point of implementing a virtual whiteboard.
Sure. Yeah. What I'd hope to do is, again, the amalgamation of tools, take the current whiteboard that we use and put it in a virtual world where when you get close to it, it's there. And in essence, you type, and because that's the current interface to this thing, you type and you're on the screen. That was a plan. Again, we'll see actually what happens. So is that fair enough as an answer? Okay. Mr. Blue. Depends on the browser. Yeah, it's a good question. Depends on the objects, you know, the objects you have in there, how many triangles they're made up. Depends on the hardware accelerator, you know, how many textures does it support. Depends on the size of the textures. Depends on the speed of the processor. You know, it depends on so many things. Mesa right now seemingly has a problem with texture speeds if the textures are above 256 by 256, okay? So big textures, and I guess it slows down incredibly. In our Onyx, some of the neat worlds, you know, like 2001 Space Odyssey, where things are moving, I mean, it looks really, really neat. Free World is not there yet. In terms of actual numbers, again, I can't tell you, but I can tell you it's also subjective. Some people say, well, that's okay speed-wise. Other people say, oh, I can see the updates, and that's not good. It's very... I honestly can't answer that.
My interest would be for CAD. Mm-hmm. Could you create a VRML model of the device and the interactors wander over the device?
Absolutely.
And the EAI to, you know, a simulation of...
Yeah. We've got a fellow in Germany who's working on a Mercedes-Benz, which goes around in a big circle. And it's a very complex model. The neat thing is it crashes our silicon graphics. Okay, which I thought, all right, well, so free world's not that bad after all. It doesn't work in free world. It's just too complex right now. But people do that with CAD. I mean, that's how they generate worlds. The thing about CAD is that if you tell it to generate a VRML world, then you have these problems with a lot of triangles. For instance, when I was down flying this helicopter, they had another guy working in triangle reduction on a helicopter, a Bell Jet Ranger or something, which they had like literally scanned. You know, laser scanned and in essence put that in via a CAD system into Open Inventor, Silicon Graphics, Open Inventor format. And there was a student there, his sole job was triangle reduction. So like he was, you know, took the skids and was, you know, taking them apart and in essence replacing these scanned in skids with his own when I was there, just to try and get the speed up. So, well, I can say is try it. It's all very subjective, and free world's not that great, to tell you the truth, in terms of speed. So, any other questions? No? Well, thank you very much for coming this Saturday morning, and hope you've enjoyed the conference, and we'll see you later. Thank you.